Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
At the end of 1599, into early 1600, villagers from Chaumont in the centre of France told magistrates of the Parlement of Paris, the criminal court whose jurisdiction covered over half the French population, of the appalling acts of rape, pillage, torture and murder inflicted on them a decade earlier, in the winter of 1590-91, by Mathurin Delaconche. This heinous violence had been carried out by Delaconche as a military captain during the Wars of Religion, when the region had been claimed in the name of the Protestant king, Henry of Navarre, soon to be King Henry IV. The village of Chaumont was accused of being allied to the Catholic League, which opposed his succession. Today's guest has examined the trial of Mathurin Delaconche, demonstrating how much could be achieved when a resourceful and wealthy plaintiff, in this case, a woman, led the charge. The testimonies that emerged from Chaumont's villagers give us some insight into what it was like to live through France's 16th century religious wars. My guest is Dr. Tom Hamilton, Associate Professor in Early Modern European History at Durham University, and the author most recently of A Widow's Vengeance After the Wars of Religion, Gender and Justice in Renaissance France. He's also written articles about the case for History Today and for the journals History Workshop and French History, all of which are currently open access. And not only that, but he's also transcribed the trial, and the full text of it can be found on criminocorpus.org. This case is fascinating, one of the fullest criminal trials to survive from the 16th century in the archives of the Parliament of Paris. This podcast contains references to violence, rape, and homicide. Dr. Hamilton, Tom, welcome back to Not Just the Tudors.
Hi, Susie. Thanks for having me again.
So I thought I'd start by asking you how you came across this trial and what about it caught your interest. I guess the question underlying that one is, what sort of history do you care about writing?
It's a trial that I came across when I was working in the National Archives in Paris, and I was particularly looking at an archive series of criminal records of the High Court of the Parlement of Paris. But really, I wanted to find evidence of people's experience of the French Wars of Religion. And it's really hard to come across ordinary people's experiences in the 16th century when most people were illiterate and sources are scarce. People might turn up in tax records, potentially, if they're wealthy enough to pay a tax, but that's not their invoices of the period. So I thought maybe if I look at criminal archives, I at least find somebody asking a question and writing down the responses of anyone who ends up in a trial for whatever reason. They're prosecuting, they're witnesses, and they might be accused. But the archives are sometimes a bit overwhelming, but I found a series of records of criminal trials, and looking through them, I realised this one was astonishing because it had probably the longest amount of testimony of any trial I'd seen in the 16th century criminal archives in France of evidence of the impact of the Wars of Religion, how people lived through the Troubles, and in this case, sought justice for some of the soldiers' violence they'd experienced.
So can you paint a brief picture, she says, setting the impossible, of the Wars of Religion up to 1590 and what that meant then for the villagers of Chaumont, which we're going to be talking about?
It's interesting, the trial comes up towards the end of the Wars of Religion, what's conventionally classed as the Eighth Civil War. It's a period of nearly four decades of conflict between Catholics and Protestants. The context of the Wars of Religion is the European Reformation, and especially the French Reformation in the early part of the 16th century, but really within France, a number of converts to Protestantism, especially in the Calvinist tradition, expands dramatically in mid-century, the 1550s, just as the monarchy is trying to clamp down on Protestant worship, increase the number of prosecutions for heresy, then I think people start to see if this faith is worth dying for, maybe then they'll want to convert towards it. So there's a crisis on the one hand of the growth of Protestantism in the French kingdom, which is Catholic, under a Catholic monarchy. On the other hand, there's a crisis of the monarchy, when in 1559, King Henry II was killed in a jousting accident. He had three sons, but none of them had children. So Charles IX, Henry III, and François Duke of Alençon died before the end of Henry III's reign. So there's a succession crisis and a religious crisis. And the combination of those two leads to conventionally eight civil wars, but really a sequence of major conflicts between Catholics and Protestants, known as Huguenots, but also a larger expanded European conflict that involves the papacy, the Spanish monarchy, a transnational conflict that involves Tudor England, the Netherlands, and it means that France in the second half of the 16th century is at the heart of Reformation Europe, and the fate of the Reformation is at hand there.
And what has happened in 1589, 1590, immediately before the events at hand?
So this is the turning point in the final phase of the Wars of Religion. They're known as the Wars or the Troubles of the Catholic League. And the Catholic League is a group that's formed under the leadership of the Guise family in France, with support of the papacy and the Spanish monarchy, to prevent the succession to the throne of the Protestant Henry of Navarre. And because the last Valois king, Henry III, didn't have an heir, that meant that Navarre was next in line by hereditary descent. Henry III was assassinated in 1589 by Jacques Clément, who's a Dominican friar from Saintes in central France, and he had no heir. Next in line to the throne by hereditary descent was Henry of Navarre, who later became King Henry IV. But before he became King Henry IV, there was a vast war to stop him because the Catholic League wanted a Catholic claimant primarily rather than the next hereditary claimant. And in between, there are all sorts of negotiations of Catholic royalists who support Navarre versus Catholic extremists, as the royalists would say, who are supporting the League. And that conflict came to a head in 1590 when Navarre's troops laid siege to Paris. Paris supported the League. There was an uprising, the Day of the Barricades, where theology students, along with Catholic militia, took control of the capital. And so Navarre wanted to win the capital and hopefully gain the kingdom, failed, went to besiege Sens, the cathedral city in central France. Again, his army failed, but it's when Navarre's army leaves Sens that the events that set up the trial take place.
So let's talk about the villain of this piece, Mathurin de la Canche. Of what was he guilty during this winter of 1590-1591?
So Mathurin de la Canche was a soldier in Navarre's armies, fairly sure that he was involved in the siege of Sens, and he was certainly involved in a much smaller siege of a small town called Valery to the west of Sens. Mathurin de la Canche and his small band of soldiers, maybe a dozen of them, that winter were looking for somewhere to stay. So they overwintered in the Chateau of Chaumont, which is a small land to the west of Sens, south of Valery, and there they claimed food and board, they claimed lodgings and possessions, they also claimed sexual power over women in the village. In the trial that happened nearly a decade later, Mathurin de la Canche was found guilty of at least 16 named identified counts of rape. He was found guilty of at least 8 counts of homicide and unnumbered amount of theft and pillage. Throughout that period, he arrives in All Saints Day, 1st of November, 1590. He leaves around just before Easter in the new year, 1591. So it's a significant period of a number of months where he's in control and is terrorising this village.
And actually, some of the records, which you have also transcribed and published so people can consult them, demonstrate a kind of psychopathic level of violence in this period. I suppose this is what the debate comes down to in terms of the trial. We'll talk a bit more about this in due course, whether this is in the course of his soldierly duties or not. But there is a sense that this is going way beyond anything that could be justified under the terms of his commission.
It's a really interesting problem. It's hard to interpret. The Wars of Religion are known as an extremely violent period of European history. There are many violent soldiers at work during the wars of religion. I think here, in some ways, there's a degree that civilians did suffer from soldiers' violence. However, the extremes of cruelty, would be how contemporaries put it, that Martin de Lacan showed, do make him stand out. And he's somebody who had a reputation for violence before he entered the Chateau of Chaumont and took control of it. In Valéry, during the siege there, he was accused, and there were witnesses proving that he had committed acts of rape at that point. He was known as someone who's very litigious. I found him in the records of the local court in Valéry 10 years earlier, or more, I found his wife trying to divorce him at that point. They're the most common people appearing in the law courts. She's trying to divorce him while they're being sued for other points. He's clearly someone who's contentious, but has a potential and a track record of committing extreme violence that was beyond what people expected or allowed, even in a most violent age of the wars of religion.
And as you say, it kind of reveals evidence of soldiers' violence towards civilians that we don't otherwise have much testimony about. But before we get any further, let's talk about the heroine of this story as well, Renée Chevalier. Now, you characterise her as the persistent widow. Can you also explain her position as seigneur and how unusual that was?
She's fascinating. When I first found the trial, I struggled to work out, to transcribe, what is Chaumont? I think sometimes the place, the proper names, are the hardest things with the handwriting, because normally you can expect the kind of things that might turn up. But names, even putting it on a map, took me a long time. When I realised that the Lord of Chaumont was René Chevalier, who married 5 times, she's at the age of 89. She sued her uncle, her mother-in-law, her third husband, her brother-in-law, and others more than that. She always won. I kept trying to find her losing a case in the trial. She's always successful in litigation, still not paying off her debts. But she's fascinating. At the point that the violence takes place, she'd already been widowed for the first time. So she was the rural lord, the seigneur of the chateau, living there with a household of servants. When Martin de Lacange arrived, she sent one of her servants to spy on him. She's one of the most important witnesses, Jean Gerbault. But it's interesting that René Chevalier as a lord, it's not that rare for women to be lords. A colleague, Erica Graham-Goering, has worked on lords in the late Middle Ages. She points out that something like 2/5 of lords in late medieval France are women. That's broadly the number of women in the US Senate, if I remember correctly. So it's not that much example of progress, but I think female lordship was a fact of life. And René Chevalier shows this, but she also shows how widows had extra capacity for legal independence, that she could start a trial on her own initiative, not responding to any husband's demands. So I think Martin de Lacange massively underestimated her when he invaded the Chateau of Chaumont. He thought that she was someone he could take advantage of. He accused her of supporting the Catholic League. She had a very strong track record of being on the opposite side of the conflict. He didn't realise the amount of opposition that he would face by invading her chateau and causing such extreme violence against her villagers.
Well, that's so interesting. So it's not unusual that she is in this position of lordship, but it is unusual that she's bringing this case. I was really struck by the fact that this case happens at all depends so much, as the title of your book suggests, on her own initiative, on her own expenditure, on her doggedness. You can see that even in the length of time it took to go to trial. But I was thinking just even about the logistics of it. She gets, is it 57 witnesses up the river to Paris? She accommodates them there for a criminal trial to testify before the intimidating Parisian magistrates. I mean, this is quite extraordinary.
She's a complete master of using the law courts in the 16th and the 17th centuries. So for the witnesses, she charters a boat from Sens that goes down the River Yonne onto the Seine and to Paris. She has an hotel, a residence in Paris on the left bank of the Seine. So I think the boat would have docked outside of her house. I found orders for wine, for wood, to keep the fires going through the winter 1599, early 1600, when the witnesses are in Paris. But by that point, she knew how to work the courts because she'd already litigated successfully over different phases. Partly, there's a point here about her status. She's a widow, she's a lord. She had failed her villagers by allowing Martin de Lacange to invade and take control. She'd failed to do justice as seigneur. But on the other hand, she's exceptional because her mother died when she was 5 years old. Her uncle took control of her guardianship. He used a third of her fortune to finance the Protestant armies in and around Sens. So he arranged her first marriage to a man called Martin Legrel, who was a financier who saved the fortunes of the House of Nevers. but then took a job in Paris instead, that he had a Protestant mother. So that was partly convenient for René Chevalier's uncle. But she sued her uncle to get her inheritance back. That took a long time. Martin Legrel, his mother, so René Chevalier's mother-in-law, was fascinating in her own right. She fled to Geneva with the Bishop of Nevers and converted to Protestantism. The Bishop of Nevers was executed for treason and for not having had a correct marriage contract when they arrived. So René Chevalier had to defend her inheritance from her first husband against her mother-in-law. So she's gone through really complex litigation and always succeeded. So she knew what was required in the law courts. What is the standard of proof? What can a plaintiff do to charter the boat, provide the packed lunch and the wine, but not provide so much of a tasty packed lunch that it counted as bribery? Martin Delacroix tried to say she was bribing the witnesses, training them, telling them what to do, giving them financial incentives. But the witnesses say, actually, no, I'm out of pocket. I spent 4 months in Paris. My shoes are worn out. I walked part of the way because I got off the boat. She did all that was required to prosecute. And it shows that in the early modern period, in the 16th century, it was difficult to prosecute. You needed resources, power, authority, and know-how. But it wasn't impossible to prosecute. And if we think that a trial that takes 8 or 9 years to get to court to prosecute sexual violence, if we think that's slow, inefficient, as we might, I sometimes wonder if that's the criticism of 16th century justice, what do we think about 21st century justice?
And there's actually a couple more obstacles in the way of this going to trial, because it's after the Edict of Nantes, which is supposed to have brought an end to the religious wars of the previous four decades, but comes with conditions. And it's in a period where, under the criminal justice system, it is hard for women to prosecute sexual crimes because of the sort of conditions under which they are deemed to have happened. They have to prove that they had resisted. They have to have witnesses. These are challenging circumstances.
It's really difficult all round. It's rare to prosecute sexual violence. I think one thing I found in researching for the book, that it's not as rare as some historians have claimed. I spotted a number going around the literature that there were only a dozen or so rape cases. And I looked into the footnotes, and typically when you start to trace it back, it comes from a myth. Actually, I found many times that number of cases in a small number of sample years. So women do prosecute for sexual violence, but still that's the exception. And I can't prove this. I have the sense that because René Chevalier is the plaintiff, it's a female plaintiff, that did encourage the women of Chaumont to testify in court. In a Parisian court, these are villagers from central France who've possibly never even seen the cathedral city of Sens, let alone Paris, testifying face to face against a soldier and a rapist, in some instances saying that he had raped them or their relatives and friends. So that required courage, but also high quality of evidence, a large number of witnesses with a clear view and a clear recollection. But that's one thing to prosecute, the challenge of prosecuting sexual violence. As you say, the other point here is the context of the wars of religion. The Edict of Nantes is one of a sequence of edicts that bring peace and religious toleration at the end of each phase of the civil wars. But the point that's best known about it is the first article. Everyone remembers that the first point of the Edict of Nantes is that you should forget the wars of religion. And that doesn't mean wipe your memory as a blank slate, but it means don't pick up disputes that were linked to the civil wars. It's an amnesty clause. And that's Article 1, but then I think this trial depends on a more specific Article 86, which is the article on execrable crimes, which basically means if an incident is so severe, so violent, which includes soldiers, rape and acts of homicide, which don't follow the orders of their hierarchy, then that is a crime, not an act of war, and it can be prosecuted, whereas an act of war would be covered by the amnesty clause. So it's a complicated balance of organising a trial, bringing the quality of evidence, but also negotiating a quite specific political context that was trying to prevent, at least prevent acknowledgement of these kinds of cases related to the Troubles.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Give us some examples of the testimonies that were given.
It's astonishing some of the things that people were saying during the trial. One example that really stuck out to me was Martin de Lacange's homicide killing of Noël Forain. Noël Forain was a labourer who worked in Chaumont. Martin de Lacange accused him of being a spy for the Catholic League. He accused everybody in the village of being against him. It's a conspiracy mindset. And so to punish Noël Forain for allegedly spying against him, Martin de Lacange tied him up, but he tied him up, according to Noël Forain's widow, so tightly it was like a bushel of wheat. And he pushed him down the hill and was attacking him with his sword. He attacked him with horse's hooves that kicked him, and apparently, according to the testimony, his eyes were bulging as a result of the attacks he suffered. That's one of the incidents that becomes most common. I think because Noël Forain was very well liked. One of the villagers said he was his best friend in the world. Another of the villagers was a childhood friend of Martin de Lacange, who said that he'd shared de Lacange's bed more than 100 times growing up together in the village of Dolo nearby. But Martin de Lacange took him hostage, tried to get a ransom for him, and tied him up. And when he tied him up, it was apparently so cruelly, he said that when the weather changed, he felt his whole body in pain, and he was so bruised, his widow said, that there wasn't a part of him that you couldn't see touched by the bruising. And he said he wished he wasn't still living. It's a really tragic testimony. And then probably the incident that's most often mentioned is the series of attacks Martin de Lacange inflicted on a woman from the village called Barbe Gauthier, who had died before the trial took place. And Martin de Lacange raped her in the great hall of the chateau in the presence of soldiers and some of the villagers. And there were some villagers who said they watched through the keyhole because they were forced to watch by Martin de Lacange's soldiers. And there, it's an important incident. It's an example of Martin de Lacange using rape as a weapon of war. And here it is the case, and social scientists, war study scholars have debated how far that is the case. What's the function here? Is Martin de Lacange, being a typical soldier, trying to make his fellow soldiers complicit in an act of sexual violence? They've all committed this together. They're all culpable. Is it to intimidate the villagers? It seems true in this case. But it's not the only incident of sexual violence. And I think one contemporary lesson that feminist legal scholars have raised from this point is to say that not all rape committed by soldiers in warfare is an act of war. That almost sounds like it's, in a pre-modern context, bears even the slightest legitimacy. It doesn't have that in the slightest. Rape is a crime. And the variety of sexual violence inflicted by Martin de Lacange was such that sometimes it was in private houses, sometimes it was in the vineyards, sometimes in view of many villagers. And it's the variety of incidents that matter. And I think it's important legally to identify what's happening, what are the conditions, what's at stake of an incident, to find the appropriate legal response.
I'm also struck by the choice you just made not to turn our eyes away from the scene. And I think there's an interesting decision to be made as historians when we come to think about this material. Because on the one hand, you want to do justice, I suppose, to the people who experienced this savagery. And that means in part saying what was done to them. And yet I'm struck by Sadia Hartman's challenge, how can we do more than recount the violence that deposited these traces in the archives? You know, how can you do more than keep rehearsing the violence against these women and men in this case as well, so that we're not just being titillated by it?
I found that so difficult to write about. I think one answer I had here was, as you mentioned, to edit the complete trial record. The source is out there. It's transcribed. It's so rare to find this kind of eyewitness testimony of soldier sexual violence, even if, tragically, the soldier sexual violence was fairly common. Here, in writing the chapter, I wanted to analyse it as a problem and think about how did the villagers tell their stories, but why do they tell their stories in a certain way? What was at stake for them? And also to think about the incidents and what, as a historian, I can say happened in a way that makes a historical question. How do we know what happened? But also, how did they know what happened? What was the standard of proof in the law courts? What did the villagers have to say to prove to the judges that Mathurin de la Cange had committed all of these heinous crimes? And so their way of telling a story in a way that was extremely vivid and situated, and I found never gratuitous, it was accurate. They wanted to give a precise account of what he had done and his motivations, because that's what the judges are looking for to find a guilty verdict. But their testimony was so detailed and precise. In a way, I relied on quoting them, letting them tell their story, and giving a sense of what justice meant to them, and to René Chevalier, who is coordinating and supporting their claims. But I was constantly, when I was editing the text, thinking, have I conveyed what their point is? Have I done justice to their testimony without making a gratuitous scene of violence for itself, but rather for the historical sense of justice that they shared?
It's interesting then to think about the way that the story was shaped for the audience, because then it would be things like having heard cries or having seen violence committed, because then you've got witnesses. It would be the fact that women would need to cry out to demonstrate that they were resisting. And one thing, as you know, I've written about rape and sexual assault in this very period in France in the 16th century, but cases that fell under that kind of legal standard for conviction, because they're being carried out in ordinary life. They're being carried out by women who quite often are going silent through the trauma of rape. But here we have a situation where the testimony has to fit the narrative that the criminal court is going to recognise as violence and as rape.
The comparison between what you're writing about in Voices of Nîmes was fascinating to me when I was analysing this trial, because there are different levels of justice. And I think with the consistory court in Nîmes that you wrote about so effectively, it was fascinating that there's everyday violence. This builds up in their community. And what goes for the consistory court maybe has a lower threshold for being denounced. Whereas what goes to a criminal court requires so much more financing and organisation. It means that you only get the really tip of the iceberg of the most extreme incidents with the most coordinated campaign to prosecute. So I think the levels of justice work together. We only know about the more everyday patterns of violence and patriarchy through the kinds of records that you analysed in the case of Nîmes. And here I've got an exceptional trial, but I'm trying to work out what elements are typical, what are exceptional. Overall, it's such a difficult problem. I had a whole chapter that I was very pleased with the statistical analysis of all the trials, and every reader said, I think that might break up the narrative. And I was quite wedded to giving a context. It now becomes a footnote and a separate article. But I think there, counting was one way of me trying to work out how typical was this, how many trials are coming to court, what's the impact of war on the business of justice, what kind of trials are there. So this case isn't alone, but certainly there are not thousands of trials like this. There may be dozens of trials of this nature, but none of them quite so well conserved. Because the archives are sifted, not every record survives. In Paris, every trial was kept in a canvas case bag. In the Toulouse archives, the case bags are conserved. There are more than 100,000 of them still, most of them uncatalogued, for the 17th century. In Paris, the judges sent the case bag back to the local courts. So the entire trial is not there. So I transcribed more than 40,000 words. That's still not the whole thing. But the copy that was kept in Paris gives that testimony, and it's just fortunate that this trial, not others, have survived. And I think here, the fact that René Chevalier was such a determined plaintiff also helps in part to explain that she made sure the records get kept in the archives.
It's so interesting. I was asked this question a lot about typicality, and it's almost impossible to answer because on the one hand, as you say, these rapes are so multiple, the violence is so execrable, this is on such a grand and such witness scale that it is obviously exceptional. And yet, it may only be here because of the efforts of Renée Chevalier, this one woman campaign to push this to justice, which means that there may be many more instances of this that just never saw the light of the court.
It's a really important question to ask. One point that I draw from this trial is that it's likely that there were far more incidents of extreme violence throughout the civil wars. This is warfare. This is civil war of a nature that impacts directly on the civilian population. On the other hand, I take some encouragement from the fact that the villagers were willing to spend 6 to 8 months of their lives to prosecute Martin Delacange and to say in the law courts in Paris and have it written down by scribes that it's not acceptable for soldiers to commit sexual violence. It's not acceptable for soldiers to ransack a village. That the customs of law might be sometimes unclear and might be debated at the time, but it's one thing for a jurist or a general to say soldiers cannot use this extreme of violence and there are uncertainties around that. But villagers know very well what's acceptable. And here they've said this goes far beyond the pale. There's a passage from the essays of Michel de Montaigne in that chapter on cruelty, where he was trying to distance himself from certain kinds of violence. He said, all peasants, they can stick a pig or pull a chicken's neck. That makes him squirm. But he thought there was maybe some difference still between the kind of everyday violence of the farmyard and the kind of extreme cruelty he saw in the wars of religion, which he thought was even more extreme than the most extreme examples he'd read in Roman histories. So judging the typicality or exceptionality of soldiers' violence, we can look at it through the law courts, we can look at it through writers like Montaigne, but I think I so appreciated work on this trial because I could judge it from the perspective of a villager called Olive Corriou, who can sign better than her husband and can say very well that Martin Delacange should not have taken her grain. She was the one villager who tried to prosecute him immediately. Didn't manage it then, but I think would have been satisfied nearly 10 years later.
One thing that came to me, you mentioned earlier that one of the people witnessing against him had slept in a bed with him 100 times. So he's from a nearby village. He knew some of the people that he hurt. And I wondered how much that played a role in the urgency of securing justice against him.
Martin Delacange clearly is somebody who's well connected in the region. He grew up in the household of the Arlet family. As it turned out, Achille de Arlet became, by 1600, when the trial was happening, the first president of Parliament of Paris. And on his day of the execution, Martin Delacange was waiting for a pardon because he thought that having lived in this household would have given him some favour. It clearly didn't. The Arlet family include Christophe de Arlet, Charles de Arlet. Christophe de Arlet became an ambassador in England. Charles de Arlet was governor in Sens. So he had significant patrons, I think, who probably got him into the army and were on the royalist side. But Martin Delacange also had patronage from René Viaud was his general, Sieur de Champlivaud. And basically, when the violence ended, Champlivaud pulled out Martin Delacange from the village and he sent 12 noblemen in, including Charles de Arlet, saying to him, at this point, you're needed elsewhere, but potentially I think he would have heard that Delacange had gone too far and had to be stopped. However, Delacange was rewarded. He became provost marshal, which is head of the highway police and military justice. He was the one in charge of military justice in the region immediately after the wars of religion. So he had a degree of protection. I found him, when he got that role, selling his farm in Dolo, buying a house in Sens. He was going up in the world. His general got the cordon bleu, the blue sash of the Order of Saint-Michel. They're being rewarded for violence in the name of Henry Navarre. So-called good King Henry here, who's patronising extremely cruel soldiers. However, when his general dies, when Delacange's general, Champlivaud, dies somewhere around 1596, then René Chevalier begins the trial. So she knows how to negotiate the local hierarchy. And one thing she also does is get a document signed by, I think it's 8 leading noblemen and office holders of the law courts in Sens, saying and signing to say, René Chevalier supported the king all along. She was never a leaguer. She was the first chateau to declare publicly for the king, so you can't doubt her credentials. And I think that really outflanks Delacange in the courtroom. He thinks he can slander her as a leaguer, but he has no idea the degree of her, or he at least has no avowed sense, the degree of her patronage network, support of the Duke of Nevers, her royalist credentials in Sens and in Paris. So the Lecarge is well connected, but his connections and his wealth don't match René Chevalier.
And do you think that's ultimately why the case is successful? Because at one level, it seems extraordinary that a soldier who has fought for the new king should then be executed for what he protests he's done in trying to establish royal authority.
In a way, it's an impossible question to answer because it's an internal versus external explanation of how law functions. And I suppose my point is that they go together. On the one hand, you need to have the circumstances that are right for the trials to take place. On the other hand, you do need the evidence. Maybe here I'm being too much aligned with the judges I work on a bit in too much detail, but I think they do have a standard of proof. They do have a standard of what is justice. Roman law in the 16th century is very comprehensive, and at least in the appeal courts, it's very hard to win a case without a body of evidence that means that the judges can say, there are valid witnesses, we have proof, whether material evidence or eyewitness evidence. But a case can't get to court, can't have support through the legal hierarchy without the right financing connections. So I think the two do go together, but René Chevalier had judged the right moment to go to trial. Among other things, she married her second husband, Charles de Lagrange, Sieur de Vèvre, in the time between initiating the investigations against the Lagrange and bringing the case to trial. So she had extra backing, and her second husband, Charles de Lagrange, he was also a military general and a governor of Issoudun. So her second husband had the status of de Lagrange's patron. So from her being at risk against a soldier and a provost marshal in 1596, by 98-99, she's got a husband of equal standing, although he sadly died within a year of their marriage, which does produce an incredible source of the inventory of her household to take account of her possessions at the moment of her second husband's death. But so for a moment, she had extra backing to take the case to court. So I think I wouldn't want to tease that any further. It's the combination of circumstances and substantive content of law that means René Chevalier can win the case, regardless of de Lagrange's attempts to say that she's using chicanery, she's bribing the witnesses, they're all liars and thieves and cheats, you can't trust her or the evidence. He tries everything, but it's not successful.
Yes, I was really struck by the various ways that he was trying to defend himself. I mean, typically, of course, impugning the sexual honour of those who are bringing charges. It's a fairly conventional approach, but, you know, call them maquerel, call them a whore and a bawd, and hope that the mutt will stick. I want to ask you one last question about this, Tom. Obviously, the experience of these villages is the primary thing here. But as a historian reading this brutal material, it also must take a certain toll. And I wondered if you had reflected at all on that in the course of coming across this trial and thinking about how to handle it. I'm always fascinated by those who can make it their work to go and provide justice, which means encountering some of the darkest elements of humanity.
It's a really important question. It's one I found really difficult throughout the research and writing. And I found it a challenge to edit, to choose the right words. But also, first, my solution to that was just make sure I was sticking closely to the text and the detail and analysing the document. The risk I actually felt, too, was having too much distance from the violence I'm describing, because I'm accessing it through a record written in the hand of the court scribe. I think about a third of the witnesses signed. Sometimes I can get access to their hand on the page. But I'm also accessing a record which is framed by the way the judges ask questions, trying to make sure the evidence conforms to the clause of actual crimes that they're looking for, translating it in so many ways. So that there's a degree of distance that comes from the record, but there's also a degree of proximity that comes from eyewitness testimony. And one thing I felt quite strongly is just that it's a really important topic. And I found it strange, looking into the wider field, how rare it is to find detailed discussion of a full trial of sexual violence of this nature, especially during warfare, when the records are not so well conserved, but also when the assumption is that this was common and didn't face any consequences, that soldiers would just get away with sexual violence. So I think at least historicizing the village's sense of justice and René Chevalier's sense of justice helped. What also helped was talking to colleagues who work on similar questions in the present. So I've got dear colleagues in Durham, the Centre for Research into Violence and Abuse, and they're practitioners, colleagues like Nicole Westmoreland. They work on the front line in terms of policy and justice and charity work, and their perspective on how to choose the right words, what matters, how the past might also give us a sense that justice can be done in instances of sexual violence. And there, I thought one thing that derived from those conversations was a sense that there's almost, I'd call it a rape myth, that back in the past, in some undetermined, imprecise date, soldiers, men could get away with sexual violence. And one point I want to say here is that they couldn't. They would face justice. Soldiers' rape in war was a crime in the 16th century. And that at least undermines any claim to use the past in a sloppy or hazy way to excuse the failures of courts to prosecute successfully today, or to excuse attempts to justify unjustifiable violence. So I think there's a broader sense of why it matters. I wanted to focus on just the content of the trial and the stories that came through the documents, but I think that bigger sense of why it matters was what encouraged me to get back to the computer screen and transcribe again or rewrite the passage of the most sensitive violence that occurred in the trial, because it matters to get it down, it matters to circulate these texts and make it better known that sexual violence was a crime and was prosecuted successfully in the 16th century.
Well, thank you very much for joining us to talk about it. And those who wish to consider more this question and to think about the realities of life in the 16th century and what a woman of initiative could do and what villagers of determination could do should pick up A Widow's Vengeance After the Wars of Religion, Gender and Justice in Renaissance France, which is out now with Oxford University Press. Dr. Hamilton, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Susie. It's a really interesting conversation. Thanks.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher, Alice Smith, and my producer, Rob Weinberg. We're always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at notjusttudors. And please remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts so you get new episodes as soon as they're released. My new online course, Henry VIII, The Making of a Tyrant, starts this April. Go to learn.susannalipscomb.com to find out more. And as a listener to Not Just the Tudors, I'd like to offer you 10% off the regular price. Use the code NJTT10 at checkout. That's learn.susannalipscomb.com, NJTT10. History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.